Welcome to Partnership Plus, your go-to source for modern partnership wisdom with your host, Phil Hayes St. Clair.
Welcome to a really interesting conversation today. I'm joined by two guys I know well, both of whom are ex-fighter pilots, both of whom have moved out of the Air Force into very interesting and exciting careers. Today, we're going to talk about partnerships, where it started in the cockpit, where it's moved out of the cockpit into other parts of life. Guys, welcome. Chris, let's start with you and your background, where you came from, what put you through the Air Force and what you're doing right now.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. I work for myself now. I help technical leaders and organizations improve their performance through better communication. It's something I've found over the 30 plus years of working that I get the most enjoyment out of, and the thing that means the most to me is communicating well with other people and connecting well with people. I spent 20 years in the Air Force, a fighter pilot, a project manager, leader. My last job was the commanding officer of the fighter training school, so a little bit like Australia's version of Top Gun. I didn't think I'd get a better job than that one, so I left the Air Force, worked in consulting for a few years in business development for a big defense company before I found my own work. Something that influenced me significantly was my experience with writing and performing poetry. I do spoken word. And through that, I realized that the creative side of communication is something that really drove me as well. So I wanted to bring that creative side with the technical and the business communication. And that's the work that I end up doing now, helping people communicate with the precision of a fighter pilot and the passion of a poet.
I love that. And when we first met, that tagline that you had really spoke to me. When we listen to pilots over different bands, we hear very specific language. No word is ever wasted. And then to transition that into something which is glorious and poetic and romantic, just so fascinating to know that it lives below the surface of all the things that you've been doing to date. We're going to dive into that shortly. Tom Gleason, we've known each other for a very long time. What's been your story?
Thanks, Phil. Dave Huey, good to be here with you guys. I joined the Air Force straight out of school. Grew up on a farm, didn't really know what else I was going to do. So it seemed like a logical thing to do, having gone to air shows, watched jets for a number of years as a kid. I was fortunate enough to get onto fast jets like Huey. Spent 15 years in the Air Force all up. After coming back from Iraq in 2003, my neck decided my time flying under high G was done. So I spent a year, you know, working in the wing doing flight safety and risk management work, which was quite fascinating, actually, and some project work as well, before actually transitioning out of the Air Force to do an MBA. Spent a few years then as a consultant with McKinsey to kind of continue the education and the learning process, knowing nothing about business before then. I've spent the last 15 plus years, you know, variously in startups, my own startup around renewable energy. Some 6 years in GE in the aviation and 3D metal printing business in sales and sales transformation. More recently, several roles in high technology, working for private equity, which is where I am at the moment, running a great little Aussie, you know, technology company based out of Melbourne, using a unique technology globally.
We got to know each other through a defence connection. There's a real shared love and brotherhood that goes right through this core. I think we've all probably been attracted to military careers for different motives, but ultimately we discover that there's a real mateship and a real camaraderie that goes with that mission orientation. And then we find ourselves in all these really fascinating jobs. When we think about partnership as a term, given all of your experience to date, do you have a reasonable definition about how you think about partnership, whether it be from the way that you worked in defense retrospectively, or maybe now in your current careers, what that means to you?
Yeah, and I really appreciate you asking this question, because it's only thinking about this that I've actually joined the dots between my service experience and business partnership, because there are obvious links that I'm only just coming aware of. For me, partnership is combining complementary skills or assets or experiences to achieve some mutually beneficial goal.
Yeah, so we're going to dive into sort of the beginning of that and giving, I guess, people a real insight into what it's like as aviators talking and partnering, because a lot of people, I'm sure, who just are avid Top Gun fans or look at movies from the outside will look at a very specific small cross-section of people that you partner with without actually understanding at all that there is such a massive organization that enables you guys to fly. And that all those things have to work in absolute harmony and in true partnership for anything to even work remotely well, let alone for sorties and missions to play out well. Tom, you're leading a high growth company. There's a lot of moving parts. You've been in companies for as long as I've known you where there have always been a lot of moving parts. How do you think about and define partnership in your context?
It's an interesting one, Phil. I actually started writing it down today in preparation for this podcast, because I hadn't actually really thought about it. And as Chris said, it helped to actually join some dots. So, you know, typically when I think of a partnership, I think of something that's very level, non-hierarchical, equal partners, you know, rather than a, you know, supplier-customer type of relationship, right? There's got to be mutual benefit. And initially I wrote down there's got to be some similar value, you know, for both sides. But then I had a bit more of a thinking about when, well, no, as long as both sides are happy, then it maybe doesn't need to be the same magnitude of value, but both sides need to be comfortable with what they're getting and define what is successful for them. Looking back to our Air Force days and some of the missions that we did, whether it be multinational exercises, you know, in Australia or around the world, or whether it be actually over in operations in the Middle East, there's a huge array of organizations that went into making a successful mission, right? The pilots are the tip of the spear, but there's, as you pointed out, there's ground crews, air traffic control, airborne controllers, AWACS, there's tankers. If they're not there, then you're not going anywhere. There's the gunnies, the guys with the bombs and the missiles. There's all our coalition partners as well. There are so many organizations that go into making a successful mission. And when I thought about what makes that successful, it really came down to alignment and that common objective. It's a bit different in business, where you may have different objectives and you have and you can trade off value because you each get what you want out of it. But from a military perspective, for me, that alignment, you know, which starts with a commander's intent and then devolves to those who are doing the mission to actually work out how it's to be done, was really the key there to making sure that a partnership stays together and aligned to make that mission successful.
Let's give people a lens into maybe three different contexts as it relates to being a pilot. Maybe the first is you're working with your peers who are sitting in, for example, a single seat aircraft, and you're part of a squadron where you've got a small number of guys or girls with you in flight. And then second, because you both flew F-18s, there is a two-seat model of that, and you might be having, as an instructor, you might have a student up front, which I'm sure is terrifying. And then you've got the ground crew aspect of that as well, where I hear stories often of new pilots coming onto base, and the only way that respect is really ever derived from the ground crews is if the pilots take a really strong investment in everything about the ground crew, from not just the individuals, but their families and all the things that go on around that, so that there's a real mutual respect for the work that goes on the ground that most people often don't see.
When you're airborne and things are happening quickly, there needs to be a common understanding of what we will do when we see something happen. If something else happens, then this is what we'll do, right? So it comes back to planning, right? Mission planning is critical, and planning together as a team with those elements that are going to be involved in the mission, so that you have that common understanding about what success looks like in that particular mission, who's involved, how we're going to operate, how we envisage the mission playing out, and then a list of contingencies on if we see this, then this is the way we'll respond. And, you know, it always refers back to the mission objective, which is, you know, the underlying, I guess, the context for the way that we behave when certain things unfold in a mission. Because there's a saying that no game plan survives first contact with the enemy. Or as great philosopher Mike Tyson says, everyone has a game plan until they get punched in the face. You know, all of those things hold true when you're flying missions as well. So having that understanding of how you're going to respond as a team when you see something is really critical to keep that alignment and coordination when you don't have time to talk.
Yeah, and look, Chris, I'm sure you agree with a big chunk of that. Maybe any other thoughts to build on that, as well as what happens when you're in a two-seat aircraft where you've got someone behind you or in front of you trying to make sure you stay on the same page when you're traveling at such a rate where a lot of things can happen very, very quickly, both good and bad. How does that play out?
Yeah, well, the things that Tom's mentioned really make that work. So there is the planning, the preparation side, where you've actually talked through what you're going to do, what's going to happen if certain things occur. With flying instruction, you even have specific words that you will use, and you'll tell the student, if I say this word, this is what I want you to do. And it's the same when we're doing operations between aircraft. We'll have what we call brevity RT, brevity radio telephony. So it's actually a series of words that we would use that mean specific things. And we've worked that out beforehand. We've agreed this is the language we'll use when we're actually in our mission or in the two-seat role in an aircraft. We have defined roles. So we've already talked about what each of us is going to be doing and how, in a partnership sense, in the broader sense, we're bringing our complementary skills and the tools that we may have to achieve the goal we've already talked about and that we've agreed on. So having defined roles is a really important thing out of that as well. And when we're in a two-seat aircraft, if you have controls in both seats, which you do if you are instructing, then we specifically let each other know when we're taking control of the aircraft and when we're giving it back to them. So that also as we're going through, we're continually communicating about who's doing what, who has control of certain aspects, certain systems in the aircraft, and we're using an agreed and common language so that we can keep focused on that mutually agreed goal, the mission, the overall purpose.
I love the idea that there's no assumption in any of that. You know, it's very overt, repeated to the point of it being very boring, that it's just, it is continuous, that everyone knows we're on the same page. I mean, none of us would ever subscribe, I don't think, to a set and forget strategy on just about anything. But when you're in that kind of circumstance, and particularly I think when you find yourself in partnership, regardless of the context, I think a lot of people can feel as though, I feel like I'm a broken record. When in actual fact, the broken record is just the beginning of where you want to be. So the ability to sort of repeat those commands, those suggestions becomes really, really important. Let's go back to ground. This ecosystem of professionals that are there to get you in the aircraft and fly. How is that for you to come onto base, developing a partnership with the people you might not have met, which is quite a routine thing to have happen in the military where you arrive at a new location, you've got to sort of re-establish connection or establish a connection for the first part. How do you think about that level of partnership? Because obviously this is not a negotiable situation, right? This has got to be made good so you can do your job well. How do you think about that from a ground crew point of view, putting aside all the other complexities when you've got other militaries involved on an operational basis?
Yeah, look, you've got to spend time with the team that looks after you, right? That team is critical for your success. And thankfully, at the squadron, there's quite a lot of opportunity to interact with the ground crew as well. And I remember one instance when we were traveling to Malaysia for an exercise against Malaysia MiG-29s. I think I spent as much time playing pool with our ground crew, trying to win money off the locals as I did with the air crew once we were away from base, right? And it's those kind of trips where you really get to know people a lot more because you are all away from home. You're working together in such close confines that it really is a great opportunity to then to develop those deeper relationships, which those guys have got your back, or, you know, in some cases, if you don't treat them well, they don't. So, you know, having those relationships is really important, and you do notice the difference between those who build those long-lasting relationships and those that are, you know, potentially more transactional. The groundies actually have a poem in the fighter squadrons, and where each of the verses finishes with "You just fly the jet." And that's the name of the poem, right? And it's a pointed reminder to aircrew who may think that the sun shines out of the proverbial, that there's a lot that goes on. We quite often break the jet, that then they have to, you know, then fix and, you know, turn it around so it's working the next day. It's a great reminder and a very grounding reminder. You know, aircrew are just one small cog, you know, in a very complex machine that creates successful missions.
Chris, what sort of experience have you had with that? I mean, you've gone from an entry-level officer all the way through to a commanding officer. How does that change over time? Because obviously as your career goes through its different evolutions, there are more and more people that ultimately end up reporting to you, and you've only got 24 hours every day. How does that ultimately play out in building those kind of partnerships?
Well, in all of those roles as a pilot, the greatest feature of the day that would help with building those relationships is that we had to go from our headquarters building to our aircraft And to get there, we basically had to walk through every other section in the squadron. So we'd go through the section that looked after our life support equipment to get our gear on. We would walk through the storage area where all of the supply people were. We would head through the hangar where people were working on aircraft, and then we'd go to the little office where you'd actually sign for the aircraft, all the way to the individual maintainer who would help you get into the aircraft and strap in. And in all of those places, if you took the time to stop and get to know people and say hello and ask them about their day, you were building those relationships. And by doing that, you build that level of trust, so you're more likely to hear the things that might affect you. So if you're a junior pilot, you might hear the things about this particular aircraft that make it a little bit quirky that you might want to look out for. And as you rise in level to where I became the commanding officer of a unit, you would hear the things that you knew you had to do something about, or give you a feeling that the squadron's going well, those sorts of things. So those are the pieces of information you get once you've spent some time building relationships and trust.
Is there a story or two that relates to partnership that you've carried forward with you from that time in the military across to your day jobs now?
The example I have, Phil, that I was thinking about, I'm not sure I necessarily carried it forward to today other than to think, look back on it and go, well, that was a pretty good day at the office because of the way that the partnership worked. And so the example I've got is one of the missions we flew over in Iraq, and I'll try and keep it really short because it could go on for a while. So we were coming back, flying back through southern Iraq on our way back to Qatar, when we got a call to come to what was ostensibly a Black Hawk down situation. There was a helicopter that had been downed by small arms fire in southern Iraq. And there were locals converging on the helicopter. The F-16s were providing overwatch, had run out of fuel, as F-16s do, and were heading home. So they asked us if we could take over. We said, of course, yes. It's like, okay, looks like we're going to be landing in Kuwait now because we need that fuel to hang around here. But eventually, and I won't go through what happened over the next 30 or 40 minutes, but then eventually we ran out of fuel as well. So, but there was no one else to take over from us. So what then evolved was a really schmick bit of work between the airborne controllers and the AWACS and a tanker crew down in the northern Arabian Gulf to come back up as close as they dared to Iraq and get us sprinting for them within five minutes or so. A very quick tank get dropped off right at southern Iraq again, and then back over the top of these of this helicopter and crew within the space of about 20 minutes. So, it's in a very abbreviated story about, you know, tremendous coordination between a bunch of different elements with a very tense situation on the ground where that risk needed to be managed as well. So that's one that sort of stuck with me is, wow, fantastic coordination, you know, amongst those guys. It was very, very professional.
Isn't it interesting too, because the precision of the objective, you couldn't have made it more precise. Chris, tell us a great story.
I've been influenced a lot by my experience as an instructor, and I actually was taught to instruct in Canada. I was on exchange with the Canadian F-18 training squadron, and they taught me to be an instructor, and they thought it would be hilarious to pair the Aussie with the French-Canadian student on the course. So for the first few rides, you'd fly with the same instructor, and student would fly together. And this poor French-Canadian guy had learnt English in the Canadian Air Force, so grew up speaking French and then was taught how to speak English in the Canadian Air Force. So good level of English, Canadian English. And when we got up into the air on one particular mission, he was not getting what I was telling him to do. Made a couple of mistakes, and I was trying to explain to him from the back seat, so just through the intercom, no, do this, you're doing it wrong. And when we get back on the ground, he looks at me and says, and I'm not going to do the French-Canadian accent, but he says, I just couldn't understand what you were saying. And it was my accent and perhaps the words that I was using and the particular expressions that I was using that he just couldn't understand. And that is when I got that strong lesson that you need to talk about these things before you get actually into the mission, actually in the air. As you said before, Phil, no assumptions. So say, I'm going to use these particular words, say them so that the other person could get used to hearing them from me, and then use those words in the air rather than trying to throw in a few Australianisms and rely on my habit of language rather than the words that we'd agreed. And after that, we did do that, and I tried to make it much clearer in closer to Canadian English so that he could follow along.
You know, it's funny, and I didn't know you were going to tell that story, but this is like the perfect segue. One of the things that we teach a lot is this idea of step one, which is shared language. And the number of times where you can ask a very simple question of two parties, tell me what success means in the context of this partnership. And you will inevitably have very different answers, even though the objective is on the board in front of them. And it's interesting just how people take on information, the way they compute data, and the way that they're trying to almost parallel process the incentives that they have personally, professionally, alongside what it says on the board. And whenever people are trying to get partnerships off the ground, no matter how harebrained or crazy it is or how vanilla it looks like on paper, the ability for people to spend three or four meetings getting to know each other, building a little bit of trust, and actually having the difficult conversation, say, well, actually, I think success looks like this, as intent gets crystallized in the fourth and fifth conversation after people get to know each other, because they feel a level of trust and comfort to have the discussion around, well, actually, I think it means this. Let's transition a little bit to post-military life. So you both transitioned. Tom, you spent time as in an MBA, went into consulting. What are some of the lessons that crystallized for you in your military life as it relates to partnership that you now bring into your day-to-day? Because like you said, you're running a multinational business which has a lot of moving parts. There are sectors that are changing. The world's not in great shape at the moment. What are some of the things that you take forward every day to help you galvanize better partnerships, both maybe inside your company or outside? What are your thoughts?
I guess one of the underlying threads through my entire career has been working in small high-performing teams, which I guess is a version of partnership. Now, whether that be, you know, a fighter squadron, an MBA group, a consulting team, at GE we put together, we had deal teams, which I didn't control, but which I ran, trying to get deals done for Qantas, for example, when running that account. And spending time in startups or scale-ups, the principles around operating those teams successfully, I think there's a couple of clear things. One is, you know, alignment, which we've spoken about before. The second one that Chris mentioned that I really liked was around role clarity as well, so everyone's clear on what the other's doing. You know, those teams are interesting because everyone has their roles, knows what they're doing, but you can't just stick in your role and not understand what's going on across the other areas as well. So, you know, so that brings me to the third thing, I guess, which is communication. You know, often to the point where it's repetitive, you know, are key. And having those regular check-ins with the team, not just, you know, an update of everything that's going on, to be very clear on what's important that the others need to know, what's not working well that I need help with from others in the team, and keeping it very focused on what matters rather than just a broadcast on what's going on. So within, you know, the company that I'm running now, Kepler, I spent some time in the middle of last year actually setting with the founder, the purpose and the vision and the values of the organization, right? So getting everyone aligned around that North Star really helps to, you know, coalesce what's important to the team and helps them make decisions on what they should be doing. And even as important, you know, what not to do as well, what we're going to make a conscious choice to stay away from because it doesn't get us towards our future state. So, and that to me, you know, creates a partnership of common objectives, a way of working, and I guess a communication rhythm that helps to keep people on track.
Yeah, and I guess also the ability for people to know that if something is not going well, and of course, most days there's probably something not going to plan, the ability for them to know that you can be approached, have that conversation, ask for help, super important. as you would do for them if you were having issues trying to solve a particular problem.
Building on your point of being able to come and talk to someone, you know, as part of a, you know, being in a high performance, you know, team. When I worked at McKinsey had the obligation to dissent, and that was, you don't just have the right to speak up if you disagree, that you actually have to, because if something goes pear-shaped and you didn't speak up, then you're equally to blame for what unfolded, because you didn't talk to anyone about it or voice your concerns. So at Kepler, we've actually taken that principle and turned it into one of our values, which is around debate and commit. And what we want our team to be able to do is to have those open, frank discussions. GE would call it, radical candor. But then once the debate's been had and the decision's been made, then you have to commit behind it, right? You can't, as an organization, agree to a course of action and then have some splitters that go off and undermine it. And when something goes wrong, say, oh, I never agreed with it anyway.
Yeah.
That's not how a high-performing team works. You agree on a course of action, and you go after it, and you're all in together. And if you don't do that, then quite easily you can fragment in your objectives, and the mission can fail.
Tom, it's fascinating, and I've heard of this before at Amazon, and it's pretty consistent across a range of different teams. How have you found people adapt to that who come from environments that was not a norm? Because I can imagine it takes a bit of time for people to feel comfortable to participate in that, and particularly coming into a McKinsey environment where they're hiring such high caliber people all the time. Do I say something? Do I not say something? Am I too junior? Am I too new? Is it going to impact how people think of me, how I'm rewarded, how I progress? How do you make that normal?
It's a great question, Phil. Where I've tried to promote this behavior across a number of organizations across a number of years, several challenges emerge. First one is where there has previously been a culture of beating up people who speak out, and where people are afraid to, because they get their head bitten off. And so in that case, really, it's about creating a safe space, and it's leading by example. Initially, you have to actually, it's like pulling teeth to draw the criticisms out, on why people might disagree. But, once they see that sort of thing is encouraged, and they didn't get beaten up about it, it's not a quick thing to do, but it has to start with a safe space. What I wouldn't say, however, is that those principles don't still apply in those areas where you have that authority gradient. It just takes a lot longer to get to a point where it becomes more natural for that to occur. When you're in a partnership and you don't know, particularly a new partnership, when you don't know the others yet and you haven't had the depth of relationship over years that, embeds trust, where you go, well, that sounded a bit off from that person, but I know them, they're good. Before you have that trust, you actually have to consciously assume that no one's going out of their way to F it up or screw you over, right? And, that has to be the go-in where you don't have the history to get that trust, right? Otherwise, there's a natural suspicion there of someone you don't know that can inhibit the right behaviors that are actually going to be beneficial for a better partnership outcome.
Couldn't agree more. In fact, it's reminded me that a habit that I've built with new partner meetings, particularly if there is a new member of the partner team coming into the conversation for the first time, I make it very overt with them that we don't know each other, but you can expect that everything said here is in the best of intent, and it assumes best intention. So if one of our team, as you say, is having an off day, if they're frustrated about something else in the previous meeting or they're preparing for another meeting, just take it with a grain of salt and feel free to ask a question. And it's actually surprising how disarming that is for a lot of people. We talk often about collapsing that time to trust, and the whole intention here is to find whatever the freeway is, which is different for every single person, to find a point of trust, and then obviously to maintain that over time, because it's difficult to build, easy to lose.
Yeah, I love that, collapsing the time to trust. And in fact, as I was thinking about a couple of the examples that I was going to give, probably the one that was almost more pertinent in some ways was when I ended up in Tamworth as the first knucklehead instructor there in 2000, and, you know, with a fair degree of suspicion amongst the others there. But thankfully, I had, you know, I think half of my pilot's course was pretty much already instructors up there. But to get in there and to actually influence, you know, how we were instructing formation, flying, and low nav, and recognizing that what was being instructed wasn't, you know, the outcome that the fast jet community needed, but to build that credibility and influence in a way that wasn't, you know, confronting in, I know bloody formation, I know this, what are you guys, you know, doing, was actually a fine balance for a number of months until people were willing to listen, and because that, you know, that trust had been developed. Thankfully also because I knew a heap of the instructors there already, you know,
that's
my
right.
mates. But yeah, it's when people don't know you, finding a way to get their trust sooner, you know, if you don't do that, it's going to be a pretty tough path.
Chris, when you're thinking about your life now and the kind of things you take into it every day, I mean, you spend a lot of time teaching people how to feel confident and express ideas that could often be quite complex. So how does that play out for you in the kind of work that you do today?
Well, I think that's a really core skill attribute that you need to have if you're going to be a good partner in any sense, whether that's in your personal relationships or business relationships with your team. It's a self-awareness and self-management and being able to know what it is you value yourself, know what are your natural styles when it comes to the way you lead or communicate, where you might be weaker and you might need to be more cautious, or perhaps get a partner to back you up and fill that weakness when you're having conversations. Being able to be in touch with how you're feeling right now, you know, how am I feeling today? Do I need to take it easy because I'm not 100%? Would it be a good idea if I go out for a walk or a run right now so that I can be better prepared for this afternoon? All of those sorts of things. Yeah. In the middle of a conversation, I'm starting to feel angry or anxious. Being aware of that and saying, oh, I better just pause for a moment, take a deep breath. All of those things help with your confidence, and they're the things that actually mean that you can have better conversations, build better relationships, and from that you have much more effective partnerships because you're coming from a position of strength. You know where you are, what you need, what you are heading towards, what you're trying to achieve, what you value, and that's much better place to be if you're going to then match it with somebody else.
Yeah, I agree. And I guess there's also this idea of how we listen over time as well. It's one thing to have really great self-awareness. It's quite another skill set and a muscle to build around being able to listen to what is being said. And sometimes when you're not feeling great, you'll hear a selected amount of data coming from one direction. And that's why when you're building partnerships, and we all know this, but it takes time to do that because you actually don't hear everything in the first meeting, in the first conversation. It takes a few meetings to do that. And as leaders, you know, we've got to try and find a way to give our teams the time and space to be able to have multiple conversations so they can get on that same page. Tom, I guess for you, let's imagine that you're giving advice to your 25 or 30-year-old self.
I think it's everything that you learn after you think you know everything that actually matters. You've got to rely on, you know, lots of people around you, you know, for your success. I've been very fortunate to have a lot of people to get advice from over the years. And I think, you know, understanding that at a young age when you're focused on, you know, your achievements and your learning and your growth and the like, it's easy to have a more myopic view. So it's the advice would be to, you know, widen the aperture, you know, take in input. You'd be surprised on where you learn lessons from, because everybody's got something to contribute.
I just want to touch on one thing Tom mentioned that we haven't specifically said, but it was a key feature of being in the military and being pilots, is that we would debrief every mission. And so that continual learning was a key feature of those effective teams that we built. So I think Tom just touched on that too. The moment you stop learning is the moment you stop living. The thing that I would go back, if I was talking to my 25-year-old self, would be to never avoid the conversation, never delay having the conversation.
Yeah,
something that I've learned quite late in my life, but conversations don't age very well. So as soon as you have a question, as soon as you feel something that you think needs to be resolved, go out and have that conversation. So talk to the people. If there's doubt or question about what you're doing, say, hey, can we just go back to our, as you were mentioning before, Phil, let's just go back to what we've written up on the wall here. And what is our purpose? What are we trying to achieve? I just want to make sure we've got it right. Or if you think that the other person is has offended you or is ripping you off or doing something wrong, most likely you're wrong, but you need to have that conversation to resolve that in your mind so that you can then progress confidently into the next step. And so I would say don't avoid the conversation.
Thank you for spending the time with me today to talk about this fascinating perspectives. Where's the best place for people to learn more about the work that you do today?
I'm very active on LinkedIn, so people can find me, Chris Hewitt, on LinkedIn, and please connect with me. I will connect with anybody who's interested in sharing thoughts about leadership and communication. And I have my own company, Understood, so understood.net.au. You can find me there and the work that I do there.
I'm on LinkedIn as well. Happy to talk with anyone interested in the transition out of the military. It's not a natural one for many, and I'm sure both, you know, Chris and I and yourself as well, having done it, are all good resources for people wanting to make that move.
Well, guys, thank you so much for giving us your time today. We'll put those links in the show notes and look forward to catching up for a beer very shortly.
Thanks, Phil.
Thanks, Phil.
Thanks for listening to the end of this episode of Partnership Plus. If you like what you heard, you can share this episode via text message. And if you'd like to build your business partnership muscle, my free weekly newsletter called Wednesday Partnership will help you do just that. You'll find a link in the show notes. Finally, I'm big on encouragement and love to see people be in motion towards their ambitions. So if you know someone who might be struggling, reach out to them with a quick message of encouragement. It could change their life. Thanks again, and I'll see you in the next episode.